This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
These are just anecdotes, but it's building up into something more coherent.
And I think it'd be interesting to really try to unravel what his ties.
There's this sort of country-city divide.
They're inconvenient. Ends, and it's not clear where it goes next.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm a pretty big movie buff, and if you were to go about engineering the perfect film for me, total Remnick bait, it might be a little like this. It would be set in the Soviet Union, where I lived for 4 years as a reporter. It would be a dark political comedy because I thrive on that stuff. And it would have actors like Steve Buscemi and Simon Russell Beale. And at the same time, it would be so foul-mouthed that I'd be embarrassed to take my kids, even though they're in their mid-20s. Now, that happens to be more or less an exact description of the death of Stalin, directed and co-written by the great Armando Iannucci. I'm not going to pretend to be impartial here. I've loved everything I've ever seen by Iannucci, The Thick of It and In the Loop, which he made in his native Great Britain.
Hey, fittest boy, lesson one. I tell you to fuck off, what do you do?
F off?
You'll go far.
And Veep, which he created for HBO, starring Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Jonah, don't talk, don't stay. You need to fuck off and go back to Westworld.
But ma'am,
you need to fuck off.
But ma'am,
I said fuck off. Three fucks, you're out.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
In The Death of Stalin, Iannucci shifts his focus from the grubbier precincts of Western democracy and takes a look at one of the most brutal regimes in history. And like Get Out, it's a horror movie that's absolutely hilarious at the same time. And maybe one that cuts a little too close to home for some, since it's currently banned in Russia. Armando Iannucci joined me in the studio. The Death of Stalin is a movie that is beyond funny, and yet thematically, it seems to fit in with so much else that you've done, The Thick of It, Veep, just the hilarious corruption of power. This is your theme, isn't it?
Well, it's it's my attempt to get away from that theme, having done it for 10 years. I suppose in Veep and Thick of It, if they make a mistake, it's embarrassing. But, you know, there'll be another day. In The Death of Stalin, if they make a mistake, they're dead, and it's a difference. It's a comedy of paranoia, craziness. It's a comedy of anxiety, really.
How did you come to this idea? Stalin dies in March of 1953.
Yes,
and he's surrounded by his henchmen: Beria, Malenkov, yes, Khrushchev, and all the rest. And I would have thought that you ran across this in a history book and were inspired, but that's not the case.
No, I mean, I was vaguely aware of the circumstances, and being a classical music fan, is that the right word? I was very fond of the music of Shostakovich, and who was the premier symphonist under Stalin and fell under Stalin's shadow for a while. Stalin criticized one of his operas, and for 2 years Shostakovich genuinely thought he was going to be taken away in the middle of the night, had a suitcase packed and everything. So that fascinated me, that idea that even if you write the wrong musical note, it could end badly for you.
I think that it was for Lady Macbeth of the Metenz District.
Yes, that's right. Yes, Lady Macbeth.
And there was a bad review in Pravda, and that was
yes.
It
was an anonymous review, but everyone thought Stalin, and the headline was Muddle Not Music. So I was aware of that. I'm, funnily enough, I had been thinking, I knew that the fourth season of Veep, I had decided was going to be my last one. And I was thinking, what should I do next? And I was actually thinking of doing something about a fictional dictator. Now, whether it was an American or a British, whether it was a comedy or a drama or in between, hadn't decided. But I started reading, you know, the classics, Hitler, Mao, Stalin.
All the funny stuff.
The Hall of Fame in terms of tyranny. Just by coincidence, at the same time, I was sent the graphic novel, The Death of Stalin, which was a French graphic novel. And I read it and I thought, well, this is it, because it was absurd, it was crazy, it was terrifying, it was horrific, and yet it was funny, it was dramatic, and it was true. And
so the graphic novel version is funny too, it's comic.
It's not as comic in terms of, I mean, it's absurd. And it was that absurdity that drew me in. And it opens with the concert that we open with. And I
so explain that for the unhappy few who have yet to see the movie.
The film opens with a concert. And this is a true story. Mozart Piano Concerto has been played. It's going out live in Radio Moscow in the control booth at the back of the concert hall. They get a call.
Hello.
This is Stalin.
Sorry, it's really noisy. I'm sorry about that. How are you? How is it wherever you are? Sorry again.
Are you there?
Receiving you.
I want a recording of tonight's performance. I'll send someone to pick it up.
Wonderful.
Was the concerto recorded? Was it recorded? Please say yes.
No, went out live.
Anything? Oh my God, I'm dead. And he runs out into the hall.
If you wouldn't mind just taking your seats again, please, that would be fantastic. Take your seat, take your fucking seats, take your seats. Don't worry, nobody's gonna get killed, I promise you. This is just a musical emergency. Take your seats, that's it. Nobody be alarmed, it's fine. Sit down, do not defy me. Sit your asses down.
At which point the conductor, frantic and panicking, faints. So now they need to find a conductor, and they scour Moscow. They eventually pull a conductor out in his pajamas and dressing gown, who comes in and conducts it. And that's a true story, except in real life, they got through three conductors. But I thought if I do three conductors, people won't believe me.
Now, one of the reasons I've read that people have become around the world, sadly, more accepting of authoritarian rule is because year by year, decade by decade, the distance between people's memories of what German fascism and Soviet and Stalinist totalitarianism were, it grows naturally more and more. It's worth maybe your describing what that circle around Stalin was like.
Yes. They, you know, for 20, 30 years had worked together carrying out his orders. There was actually a quota system for rounding people up, which, of course, if you think about it, maybe night one, you get the enemies. Night two, you're struggling. So you're just giving people the names of people you don't like. By night three, night four, you're just giving them the names of people you know, because otherwise they might come for you. They're carrying out these orders. Khrushchev was known as the butcher of Ukraine in the 30s. He carried out the enforced collectivization of the farms and the deliberate famine imposed on the rural workers. It was an attempt really to rid the country of lowly laborers. Stalin wanted the country to be industrialized. It was all about steel. And I'm not going to mention tariffs, but it's about steel, not vegetables. So they had been through it. They had all collectively signed death warrants. One of them, Kaganovich, for his own brother. They all lived near each other. They all lived in these apartments. So they all their children played with each other, even though he might have signed the death warrant for my father and I might have signed the death warrant for her sister. Somehow they had to just live with this idea that what they had done was what Stalin wanted and therefore was right. So what must they have had to hide from each other and from themselves to kind of live and exist and survive through all that.
Still funny.
All right, comrades, now that we're quiet, I propose we call a doctor.
All the best doctors are in the gulag or dead.
Yes,
Yes, because they tried to kill the boss.
So any doctor still in Moscow is not a good doctor.
What are people's thoughts on getting a bad doctor?
What the fuck are you talking about? That's mad. What if he recovers and finds out? Well, if he recovers, then we got a good doctor. And if he doesn't recover, then we didn't, but he won't know. What was the name of that woman who gave evidence against the doctors?
Tomaszuk.
Yes, she's got everything we require for this situation. The location of all the remaining doctors in the Moscow area, a proven desire to survive, and a talent for fellatio.
Right, she gets my vote.
Yeah, good. Let her find us some doctors.
Yeah, and if it goes badly, we pin it all on Lady Suck-Suck.
Then we shoot her. Yes, that would work.
You see? We're better as a committee. Let's go on.
But the point I'm trying to get to, yeah, though, is just as Mel Brooks, decades ago, somehow imagined a comic turn on Hitler with the producers and Springtime for Hitler, which outraged people. How did you make the comic leap?
The first thing I said when we started shooting was, look, we have to be terribly respectful about what happened to the Soviet people at the time. So there's no comedy about mass killings and shootings. That's played for real. We don't try and hide it, and we don't try and dilute it. We just let it play. That's the tragedy. But indoors, in the Kremlin, that's where the comedy is, in those apartments. They're like gangsters. They're like a group of gangsters. There's something funny about The Godfather. If you watch The Godfather, there's a lot of comedy in The Godfather. They're kind of, it was just business.
Right.
You know, like, where's the cannoli? Get the cannoli while they're beating someone up. You know, there's a lot of that, of strange, dark comedy. We discovered as we were researching the film that joke books were circulated under Stalin. Jokes about Beria and Stalin and torture and rape. And if you were found with a joke book on your possession, you could be shot.
That was worse than having a Solzhenitsyn years later.
Yeah. Because this was making fun of the leader.
But this kind of poking fun at the politically powerful is something you do in your other work. Would you admit that there's some sort of thematic unity to these big projects that you've done?
Well, I suppose, yes. I mean, what I've learned from Veep has gone into the death of Stalin. And also, but then I wanted to take myself out of my comfort zone by taking on these themes that involve death and destruction and it's paranoia.
It's not just schmucky people in Washington and modern jobs.
No one's upset about a tweet in this in this movie. That's the least of their problems, you know.
Now, a biographical thing, your father was part of the resistance to Mussolini in Italy. Did his experience of life in a dictatorship affect your relationship with this kind of material?
Well, it's interesting, yeah. I mean, at a very young age, you know, at age 15, 16, 17, he was writing for an anti-fascist newspaper and then joined the resistance. And then when he came over to the UK after the war, he didn't take out British citizenship, so he couldn't vote. And I said, why don't you vote? Because, you know, you fought for democracy. And he said, last time I voted, Mussolini got in. And that was his way of saying, don't think because you have a democracy that it's perfect. You know, Hitler got in through an election.
And now it's happening all over the world.
And this is what's happening. This is why I was interested in the idea of dictatorship as my next subject, because this is what's happening. People use democracy, the guise of democracy, to then change the rules. I mean, what you were saying earlier about people who've forgotten what Nazism meant or Stalinism or fascism, because they've grown up with democracy, if they get fed up with it, if they're annoyed with politicians, if they feel politicians aren't talking to them, they start to think, well, there must be something else then. And there are those bizarre, frightening statistics about 20%, 25% of people say, you know, democracy isn't the only system that they might be interested in. And what's happened in our democracy, this is why the likes of Donald Trump have had such success, is politicians have concentrated more and more on those few who change their minds, the independents, the swing voters. More and more people have felt that they aren't being listened to and they've felt disenfranchised and therefore they don't participate. And then someone like Trump comes along and says, okay, you know, I'm going to talk to you.
So oldest question in the book, though, about this and your work, is it possible that people see your work and it has some, beyond making them laugh, does it help make them see or reimagine reality?
I hope so. I mean, that work is born out of a sense of frustration I found in how democracy works and how, you know, I felt something like the Iraq war with Britain's participation with America in the invasion of Iraq against every conceivable expert, scientific, objective, non-objective, emotional point of view. Everyone's saying this will be a disaster. How someone in the UK, our Prime Minister Tony Blair, could somehow bend the will of Parliament, the will of his party, the will of the military, the will of intelligence to make this thing happen. So that was really why I wrote The Thick of It and In the Loop. And it's to do with that, okay, what happened in democracy here that this could, and therefore how are decisions made, and therefore what does go on behind the scenes?
You didn't film in Russia. You filmed this in England, right?
Mostly in London, and then a week in Kiev, and then a couple of days in Moscow.
Oh, you did? But yes. You did a lot of research in Russia,
yes,
am I right?
Yes, went out to Moscow. And
what did you learn there? What did that give you?
We spoke to younger people now saying, what are you told about Stalin? And they said, we're taught at school, they said, some people say he killed millions, other people say he industrialized us and made us a great power. You decide.
Because right, when I lived there in the late 80s, early 90s, that was the period of anti-Stalin.
Yes.
The Kremlin was speaking out against Stalin.
Yes.
The whole business was about de-Stalinization of society.
That's right.
And new textbooks.
But
now it's moved somewhere
else.
It's
about authority figures. It's you know, the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution, they didn't really celebrate the revolution because that's all about bringing the government down.
Yeah, they don't want that.
But they celebrated the victory in the Patriotic War, the Stalingrad, the strong leader, Stalin as a strong leader. In Moscow now, there's a statue to Tsar Nicholas II as well, and Peter the Great. That's the message, the kind of authority figure at the center.
Well, apparently your film was screened once or twice.
Yes.
And you had every expectation of there being a regular run.
We were given the license. You have to get a license from the ministry. We were given it. We did our press screenings. The press applauded when Stalin fell over. we dubbed it into Russian. It was going well. And then 2 days before the actual opening night, the license was withdrawn.
What happened? Do you know?
I think someone in the Ministry of Culture panicked. And there is an election coming up.
There is.
They said it was an attempt to subvert. And we know how much a stickler Putin is for not having anyone interfere in the elections of another country. I mean, that's an absolute golden rule.
It is.
A golden rule.
And obeyed at all turns.
Absolutely.
Yes.
So we can see how, you know, he didn't want that line to be crossed.
So we showed once or twice, but just to the press,
Cinema in Moscow decided to show it anyway until it was raided by the police.
To regular folks. It was raided in the middle of the screening?
Yes. I say raid, which makes it sound like, you know, people stormed in. Some police turned up and said, what's showing here? And they said the death of Stalin. And they went, uh-huh. And then they walked up. They left. But the cinema then had to withdraw it. But, you know, how can you ban a film these days? People are going to see it. Somebody tweeted me a photo of them watching it on their laptop underneath Putin's window in the
Kremlin. So people are ripping illegal copies?
Yes, yes.
Are you happy about that?
No, I've reported them to the higher authorities. I mean, that has to be stamped out.
Absolutely.
It's the worst crime of all, isn't it? Piracy?
It's terrible, terrible, terrible. You mentioned earlier that you had planned to leave Veep after its fourth season.
Yes.
Why? What was driving you?
Oh,
was it the commute?
The commute, United Airlines' inability to apologize under any circumstances.
It is terrible, isn't it?
To be honest, by the fourth series, I thought, I think I've said what I wanted to say. So my last episode was the one where it ends in an electoral tie. And that, for me, was my finale. And what I've enjoyed about it is actually becoming a viewer again and being able to watch it not knowing what the hell is going to happen next and what anyone is going to say next.
Now, you finish a film. You, like many other filmmakers and authors, once it's done, and there's no need to dwell. What are you thinking about next?
I'm doing Charles Dickens' David Copperfield.
Different. And you can get all 800 pages into a 2.5-hour film? Or is it a series? Or how do you envision
it's film. I wanted to try and remember what it is I love about the book. And it's the language. It's the characters. It's the psychology. It's the emotion. The story is very slight. I mean, Dickens' stories, I mean, he was sort of making it up as he went along, doing these monthly and weekly installments. Too many adaptations pay so much homage to the story. There's a fantastic scene in it where David, age 18, gets drunk for the first time. And all of London is swimming in front of him, absolutely swimming. It's hilarious. It's never in any adaptation because it's not part of the story. So the idea is it's inspired by the themes within the books. It's going to be 1840s London, but I want it to feel rather like contemporary London. I want it, it should feel exciting. It should feel like ancient Rome. It's the capital city of the mightiest empire in the height of the Industrial Revolution. For any, you know, 17 and 18 year old arriving in London for the first time, it should look tantalizing, you know, exciting, and yet have this cruel aspect. And I want to explore these kind of emotions. It's all about what happens. It's status anxiety. That's what it's about. It's 1 minute being rich and the next minute losing everything, and how you behave then, and the friends you want to try and have, and then suddenly realizing that the friends that mean most to you are the ones that you started to look down on the more successful you became.
One of the funniest aspects of Ian Parker's profile of you in The New Yorker some time ago was the very careful obsession with the mechanics of obscenity and obscene speech. So much so, I think you even had a, like an advisor on this.
Yeah. I mean, I don't swear. I'm not swearing.
I don't believe a word you say. Was there swearing in Dickensian England?
Well, certainly not in the novels. There won't be swearing in the film.
Well, we have small disappointments. Armando, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you very much.
Armando Iannucci's movie, The Death of Stalin, starring Steve Buscemi and Simon Russell Beale, is just out in theaters. Ahead this hour, another view of that bleak era of Russian history from the woman who's been described as the Studs Terkel of Soviet life. You're listening to the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs, because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Hey, Jon Favreau here. There's no shortage of political takes in 2024, but quantity doesn't cut it. We need a better conversation about the latest biggest election of our lives. On Pod Save America, me and my co-host cut through the noise to help you figure out what matters and how you can help. Every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, Pod Save America is breaking down the political news that makes us laugh, cry, and snap our laptops in half. Expensive year for laptops. Make sure to check out new episodes of Pod Save America on your favorite podcast platform or our YouTube channel now.
Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
This is kind of an experiment. We've never this is a new show. We've never done this before.
Новое шоу. Мы раньше этого никогда не делали с переводом.
Я очень неопытный в данном случае.
Да, я думаю, что мы просто разговаривать будем без этих.
When the Nobel Prize in Literature was awarded a few years ago to Svetlana Alexeyevich, it surprised people in a couple of ways. First of all, Alexeyevich, a Belarusian writer, was a totally unfamiliar name in the United States, even to big readers. Even more unusual, she's a nonfiction writer, and that's very rare with the Nobel Prize. There's no dearth of literature about life under the Soviet regime, but nothing quite like Alexeyevich's work. She puts her books together from interviews with regular people,
somewhat like what Studs Terkel did about working life and the Depression in this country. But her big themes are life in the Soviet Union and the painful aftermath of its breaking apart. Svetlana Alexeyevich has been described as a journalist, but she sees it somewhat otherwise. She actually bridles at the term.
Когда хотят сказать, что это журналистика, нет, это не журналистика.
It's not journalism. It's a different view on things. It's the view of literature. It's a wider view. Journalism deals with banalities. It picks up only the surface layer. I am also a witness of this time, and I approach another witness, and we try to talk. I try to make it so that people speak, as Dostoevsky said, in what he called a more human language, a deeper language.
И эти люди, они вокруг меня, это мои соседи, это мои друзья, это люди, которых я вижу на улице.
And these people are the people around me. These are my neighbors, my friends. These are people I see on the streets. I didn't need to seek them out. Enter any house, and so much suffering will be poured out to you that you'll hardly be able to walk out of the house.
Потому что документ — это живое существо, оно находится в движении.
Also, this document is a living creature, and it changes. In 2000, for example, after Perestroika, the women in my book War Has Not a Woman's Face, they said, we want to meet with you again, because back then, we didn't tell you everything. We were afraid, or we didn't understand.
There's a wealth of fascinating interviews in this book, and there's also a refusal to differentiate between the oppressed and the oppressor. For example, you're talking to an architect named Anna, who's about 59 or 60 years old. And at one point, after she's talked to you for many pages about her life and her suffering, she says that people now are all trying to put on the striped uniform of the victim, of the prisoner, but somehow now everyone's the victim and Stalin is alone to blame. But think about it. It's simple arithmetic. Millions of inmates had to be surveilled, arrested, interrogated, transported, and shot for minor transgressions. Someone had to do all of this. To what extent is everybody from the Soviet past an accomplice?
Дело в том, что я могу сказать, что в 90-е годы мы очень судили.
The truth is, in the 90s, we really judged our parents. And I remember how I fought with my father when I went to Afghanistan and saw what the Soviet army was doing there. I came home and I said to my father, who was very much a communist until the end of his life, Papa, we are murderers. And he began to cry. He didn't argue with me. That doesn't mean I don't have an obligation to give a voice to a person like my father, to cry out his life. In my work, everyone cries out their own truth. I never allow myself to say, this one's just a stereotypical Soviet, this one's part of the herd, as they sometimes say. Because first of all, that's not the truth. That's arrogance. From the point of view of art, both Stalin and the victim are equally interesting. We must understand, what is this? Who are they? Why? But that doesn't mean that the executioners and the victims are equal. To understand good and evil, portraits of their vessels must be studied and meticulously painted.
Для меня, например, было очень радостно слышать, когда
I was very glad when at a meeting in France, one young man stood up and said, I don't understand. What is the problem with your people? You got freedom and you refused freedom. What kind of people are you? But I read your book and it became absolutely clear to me where Putin came from, why you had refused freedom.
Well, maybe you should answer that question a little bit more broadly and deeply about what comes out of this. The book is filled with stories of people whose hopes were raised, who were confused by and yet thrilled by the late 80s and 90s, and then fell into immense disappointment, confusion, and poverty.
Да, почему мы идем все время по кругу истории и все время, как говорят...
I think I try to answer this throughout the whole book. Why do we walk through this circular history? Why do we, as we say in Russian, step on the same rake again and again? In the 90s, I remember, my generation really believed that tomorrow would bring freedom. We ran through the squares, we cried out, freedom, freedom, and then we went our different ways, into our houses. And then we acted as if Yeltsin would bring freedom, Putin would bring freedom, someone would bring it.
Does this pattern of repeating history to some degree, the inability to for the Russian people and people in surrounding countries to thrust themselves out of this terrible cycle of history, is this related to what people talk about when they talk about русские особенности? Is there something about Russia, Russian history, Russian geography, character somehow that is a kind of destiny.
Мне кажется, это вечная русская мечтательность, вечная русская надежда на чудо.
It seems to me that it's the eternal Russian dreaminess, the eternal Russian hope for a miracle, that we can go immediately from feudalism to a developed socialism. That kind of socialism could maybe happen someday. There's nothing wrong with that idea. But you can't do that right after feudalism. In 1917, when World War I had just ended, Russia was one of those backward countries. Russia had been bled dry. It wasn't the place to build socialism. And then the provocative Leninist slogans that brought out human nature, loot the looters, right? Or with an iron hand we shall drive humanity to happiness. That kind of thing from the first years of the revolution. So I think that what happens is what always happens. Russia always needs an idea, a purpose to be obsessed with.
Now you live in the era of Putin. How do you understand Putin? What does Putin understand about Russia that Gorbachev and Yeltsin did not?
Я помню, как после 90-го года вот все мы, демократы...
I remember how after the 90s all of us Democrats said, why are the people silent? We talk and talk, and the people are silent. And suddenly Putin arrives, and after a while he takes off all his masks, his playing at democracy, and speaks. He says, we need a great Russia. They are annihilating us. They are insulting us. They don't deal directly with us. And suddenly the people began to speak. And when they began to speak, it became clear. It's absolutely clear now. Gorbachev and a few of his companions created the revolution of the 90s, and the people weren't ready for it. When I was writing Secondhand Time, I traveled all over Russia. I heard the hatred, the grievances of this robbed, deceived people. There's no reason to demonize the figure of Putin like everybody does, thinking of him as the problem of problems. In truth, we're talking about our collective Putin. He has made himself the focal point of the desires of millions of people. Putin is only a metaphor for that longing. He didn't come up with it on his own. What he's doing today is really what the people want. And the Kremlin has been able to redirect all of this upheaval and dissatisfaction to find an enemy outside our borders.
I have to tell you, when I watch Russian television, the number one enemy is the United States of America.
Yeah, in some cities, they burn Obama in effigy. And not very long ago, in Yeltsin's time, America was considered our best friend. Putin appears about once a year in front of some youth organization to give a kind of program speech, and the topic is always the same, that Russia is great, but America is insulting us, Europe is insulting us. It's always an outcry that they're considered politically little punks. No one takes them seriously. It's serious, even dangerous, when a national leader like Putin says that whoever doesn't understand our politics is a national traitor. That makes me a national traitor, and others. You understand, it's the lexicon of Stalinist times.
So on the one hand, your books are published, you travel freely throughout the world, and on the other hand, you are a predatel, a betrayer.
Да, и если раньше, вот когда я писала вот книгу
yes.
раньше, вот
when I was writing 3 years ago, before Putin took off all his masks, people were ready to speak. Now they're cautious. There are three forbidden themes: Putin, the church, and it's impossible to speak about the Great Patriotic War, the Second World War. So, for example, when I won the Nobel Prize, I was hounded. It turns out I'm a Russian traitor, a Russophobe. I hate the Russian people. That is Putin, right? It was endless. Because of the Nobel Prize and my Nobel address, they rushed to talk about their opinions of me. What I always wanted when I wrote was for my books to start a discussion. For a long time, we've needed to start a discussion. Who are we? Where are we from?
Svetlana Alexandrovna, a final question, and it's the question you seem to pose to all of your interview subjects in this book. And on the one hand, it sounds corny. On the other hand, profound, which is to say, what does freedom mean to you? This is the question you ask everybody, and it arouses incredible divergent answers. What does it mean to you?
Ну, я могу сказать, что у меня есть вот эта счастливая возможность.
Happily, I can say that I can live freely. But unfortunately, many of us don't have that freedom. I can say what I want, I can write and do whatever I consider necessary. I consider myself to be a free person. And now I'm meeting with people and gathering material for two books. The first is about love, and the second is about age, about disappearing, about the 20, 30 years that progress has given us, about life without a governing idea. How does that work for us? What is it? I mean, without the kind of big idea that is always foremost in our culture, like communism or fascism.
Сначала, значит, строили великое государство.
In the beginning, they built a great state. There was no individual person. There was a kind of collective body of people. Then they built communism. There was no person, no differentiated body. And the person, where is the person? What is a person? Does he want to be happy? Does he want to die? Is all we have developed over all these years a culture of death, a culture of suffering? I can only say that my father, as I said, was a communist and believed until the end. But a lot happened to him. Alzheimer's, all that, his memory totally left him. In the beginning, he talked only about the war, about the Battle of Stalingrad, and about how beautiful my mother was. And when everything, when all of that left him, the last thing he talked about was how beautiful my mother was. I thought, only this terrible disease has freed him to speak about human things.
Svetlana Alexeyevich, winner of the 2015 Nobel Prize. Talia Levin at The New Yorker translated her responses into English for us, and we heard the voice of WNYC's Emily Botine. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour.
I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Nicholas Niarchos is a contributor to The New Yorker, and he has the challenging beat of reporting on a war that, frankly, many Americans don't even know we're involved in. The war in Yemen is both a civil war and a regional war with more powerful neighbors, Iran and Saudi Arabia, involved. At the same time, the United States is supporting and enabling the Saudis' air war. Hundreds of thousands of people have fled Yemen, and many are in Djibouti in eastern Africa. Nick Niarchos visited one of the refugee camps there in 2016.
It's 50. Okay, 50. So should we go one like that and one of the other ones over there?
The camp in Djibouti was hot and dusty, and people were miserable. But Nick met a man there who had a unique way of coping with tragedy and finding beauty wherever he could.
So it's in the middle of the desert. You arrive at the camp. It's incredibly, incredibly hot. When you walk out of an air-conditioned room into this heat, you feel like you're going to be physically sick. But you don't really smell anything because it's so hot. All your senses are overwhelmed by the heat, and everybody's looking for shade. So you walk through the camp and people come up to you and say that they want to talk to you about different things. They want to complain about, you know, not having air conditioning or not having adequate food. And these are all really serious concerns. But at one point, this man approached me and he was smiling.
Lovely, isn't it?
And laughing. And I didn't really understand, you know, what there was to smile and laugh about. And he said,
My place in morning early is very, very nice. I wish if you come.
He said, you must come to my tent. You have to come and see my tent. Walk down this way. He pointed towards the Aden sector. And he said, you'll go to this place and you'll hear the birds singing. And then you'll have arrived at my tent.
You will be surprised when you see my free birds all around my fencing. They found the freedom. They found somebody who to feed them. I show you, come. Please, sorry. I have different kinds of food.
His name is Abdullahi Bashir Hill, and I hadn't been invited into somebody's house like that. People have come and said, you know, I want to speak to you about this and I want to speak to you about that. But this was just somebody inviting me to see what he'd built in the camp.
Sorry, that's my gate.
Ah, I see. Thank you very much.
We went through a low gate.
Wow, it's really quite a collection around here.
And the fence was sort of posts joined by wire, and then there were sort of skulls hanging on the wire and pieces of wood and, you know, dolls' arms and various different sort of bits and bobs, basically, that he'd collected from the desert.
So, this is a civilian museum. Look, this.
So walking into the museum, there's one tent which covers a series of plants that Bashar Hill is growing.
Oh, wow, this is... So you've got a whole garden in here.
Yes.
What sort of...
Green pepper and bidingal. I don't know what you call in English. And that's all.
And there is a little sort of day bed in the middle of the museum. And you look around and it's completely different from everywhere else in the refugee camp. I've been thinking about this a lot since I came back, because it's this quality of sort of being inside a place that's walled off in this incredibly harsh climate, and suddenly you feel like you're in this little garden and this little oasis and this little paradise, and the rest of the world kind of melts away outside.
I will show you something. Look. Look. I remember now. A saw. A saw.
Bashar Hill could sound crazy to people, but he's actually somebody who doesn't really come off as crazy when you meet him. He just kind of bowls you over with this great deal of energy. But he definitely is eccentric.
A sword.
Oh, wow. It's a very, very small sword.
Yes.
Oh, wow. Why do you keep it in water like that?
It is not water. Oh. It's, you know, gas and oil. Because if it's gold, when you keep it for several weeks, it became shining.
Well, he's a funny guy, and he, you know, I was trying to ask him about his life before the camp, and he would always sort of crack these little jokes.
Can you tell me a bit about your life when you were in Adan as a child?
When I was as a child,
yeah, for your life beforehand.
More handsome than you. Believe
sure,
me.
I'm sure.
I was very, very, very handsome. And I was also very, very bad. I am very bad because God make me very soft.
Okay.
This is my problem. I am a soft person. This is my problem.
Bashar Hill worked as a road surveyor in Yemen, and he worked for a lot of Western companies, and he was actually a successful and pretty well-educated guy. He is a 63-year-old man. He doesn't have a wife. He doesn't have kids. He's from a sort of a well-known Yemeni family, but he's not independently wealthy particularly. He lived in Aden in the Mualla district, and he had built a good life for himself.
Tell me about your life in Adan.
In Adan.
Before the war.
Before the war. It was very, very, very good. Until they started the war. We became like animals.
He escaped in April of last year.
Discrimination.
He didn't have anything. He had the shirt on his back and he had a pair of trousers.
We became like slaves.
He arrived by himself, and he has made do in this camp ever since.
So thanks for God that I'm in Djibouti. I reach this place.
Bashar Hill has suffered a great deal. You know, he's lost his home, he's lost his country, he's been displaced, and he feels like he can never go back. And that's something that profoundly affects somebody.
So how come And how come to live with people like that? The government in their hands.
Because of that, he tried to sort of root himself in this new place that he's found himself in. And he's tried to sort of leave a mark there. And I think this is kind of, he's planting trees and he's built this little museum. That's a bomb.
That's a bomb. Exactly.
It's a sort of small, smallish, a mortar shell, really.
This is, you know, this.
It's a larger 50 caliber bullet.
Yeah, bullet, yeah. This.
It's an unused bullet.
Yes.
7.62, probably, from a Kalashnikov. He used to be a road surveyor in Yemen, and he is very, very aware of distance, and he's got a very good sense of distance, and he walks for 20 kilometers every day by himself. He only walks by himself. And looks at the ground and picks up objects.
This is, you know, you can anyhow see it.
A pestle and mortar.
Yes. This is an old radio. It's no use to bring it, but I like everything is old and new. I found it in the garbage. I add to my museum. Look, and this.
He's not just a collector. He is an artist. He had this artist sensibility of wanting to leave his mark and wanting to kind of improve things by piecing material parts of his world together.
And this is an eagle face. Look, eagle face. I make it from stone, and when you go a few meters from far away from it, it looks like an eagle face.
You know, like from stone and wood.
It looks like wing. Huh? And this is the face of the eagle, you know.
If somebody were to act like this in you know, New Mexico, they could be called a found objects artist. But this is somebody in a refugee camp in Djibouti.
There is another story. Why I escaped?
Everything that he had in this life was taken away from him by the war. But he's a hopeful guy.
There were two birds here.
Bashir Hill had two birds. He showed me the cage.
And I was looking to them.
And he said,
there is a third bird.
That one day he looked over at the cage and there was a third bird sitting there looking at the two other birds.
I looked, his eyes seem, he's very sad. He's seem crying.
He said that this was, this affected him, and he didn't want to keep these two birds caged. And he said, I free you for the sake of God, and opening the cage, letting the birds into the sky.
By chance, in the same day where I freed the birds, they told me the ambassador of USA will visit you.
So the ambassador was coming, and Bashir Hill thought, what am I going to say? What am I going to do? How am I going to welcome him into my museum and show that this is a sort of big occasion?
I said, how can I greet him? I have no birds. I have only chicken.
And
he found
two other birds. And when the American ambassador arrived, he released the two birds into the sky as a sort of message of greeting.
I said to him, greeting you, you know, and let the birds to fly.
Bashir Hill releasing these two birds might seem to us like a very sweet gesture, and it was. But it was also a sacrifice, because these birds are a very valuable commodity within the camp. And he, in doing this, showed a great deal of respect for the ambassador. And when I called the ambassador, he was effusive in telling me how touched he had been by the warmth of Bashir Hill's greeting, and how interested he had been to look around the museum. And
While he had been there, Bashir Hill told him about a dream that he had, which was to be resettled in the United States or somewhere in Europe and to build a new museum. And he thought that by making his case to the ambassador, he would stand a better chance of being repatriated. The tragedy of the situation is that the ambassador is not in charge of refugee resettlement. It just seems to me a very, very long shot that he will be coming here.
After when I saw his reply, I don't want to talk too much. He smiled. I know his smile. He's keeping for me something. Maybe one day he will collect me. And I don't know, maybe soon. He's an ambassador.
That's Abdelahi Bashrahil, a refugee from Yemen. He spoke with Nicholas Niarchos of The New Yorker in 2016. And Nick will be back on the show next week with more reporting on the war in Yemen and its human costs. That's next time. For today, we're going to close the show with the poet Tracy K. Smith. The first poem of Smith's we published in The New Yorker was a poem about Levon Helm, the drummer and singer of the band, which warmed my heart. And not too many years after that, in 2017, she was named the Poet Laureate of the United States. With signs of spring beginning to creep up, at least here in the Northeast, Tracy offered to take us on a little journey near her home into the woods.
We are at my home in Princeton, New Jersey right now, and we're heading into what is known as the common land or the common wood that sits in this neighborhood, which is called the Gray Farm neighborhood. And that's my dog, who's jealous that she's not coming. And it leads out to Lake Carnegie. We're walking along like a bed of bark, this path, and there's some tree stumps that have been lined up to create like a little guide to the path. To the right, we see some of the houses that look out onto the lake. You can see the bridge up ahead, the cars going into town off to the left. One of our neighbors planted, I think, thousands of daffodil bulbs, so we'll pass those. Some people have what my kids call bamboo forests. You'll see some neighbors up here have bamboo at the back of their property, and it's just kind of this open space. I loved being a young writer in New York and having my community of people and our sense of a hunger and excitement. And then I had kids, and my father died. So we left New York City and moved here. And I had a little bit of, I was anticipating having heartbreak about leaving Brooklyn, where I'd lived for so long and was so happy. And then I came here and I was like, oh my God, this is the real world. Like, there are these trees that are just electrically green. And I feel like something in me has changed as a result. Like I don't know. I feel like the trees are doing more than just giving oxygen. I think they're these old souls that kind of console in different ways. And so there's something beautiful about this as a backdrop of what feels like a new beginning, or the beginning of what comes after youth. And maybe I feel sort of consoled by the fact that the landscape just keeps going despite all of the things that we do. That's really been the really most beautiful surprise of being here, how much silence and green space has fed the inner silence that I think most writers are seeking. had a teacher once who, Linda Gregg, the poet Linda Gregg, who said, if you are suffering from writer's block, it's really just anxiety that's keeping you from being quiet. If you're quiet, after about 15 minutes, your mind is imaginative enough to come up with an idea to prevent boredom. And I feel it's so true. In my 20s, I couldn't write. I had so much anxiety about what people were saying, what my classmates and teachers were saying about what I was writing, that I just kind of stopped for about 9 months, which really hurt. And my strategy at that time was to take a photography class, just to be doing something creative and learning to look at things through that lens. And I think it helped bring me back to the page, because I recognized something I hadn't quite articulated to myself before, which was that an image can do such amazing lyrical work, and it can free you from the need to make statements and explain. If you can just describe, a feeling can emerge that the reader can't help but participate in. And before that, I thought poems were a series of wise statements that someone who had discovered things laid out one after another. And so I was, no wonder I had writer's block. I could figure out maybe one thing that seemed genuinely interesting, and then a couple of other things that were in imitation of a wise person, and then I couldn't get past that. The first thing I want to look for is something that has to do with a bird or something natural. I feel like there's an effortless sense of clarity that I can locate in some of those types of sources. Yeah, sometimes what I know is, look, there's a deer. Several. Oh, wow. No matter how many times you see one, you still get that same feeling of, oh, how lucky. I'm sorry, guys, I'm bothering you. Wow, I can't believe we made it back the way we came in. This almost never happens to me when I'm by myself.
The poet Tracy K. Smith. You can find some of her poems at newyorker.com, and she has a new book about to come out called Wade in the Water. And that's it for today. Thanks for joining us. I'm David Remnick. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Calla Leah, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Terrence Bernardo, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund. Thank you.